I would like to acknowledge the Kaurna people who are traditional custodians of the land here. I'd also like to pay my respects to elders past and present of Kaurna country.
Are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Flame we trust will lead us forward as we travel in unknown lands, where the question, shall I ever get there, resounds, a clear, pure note in every silence. These words were from Barnaby Feeder, a journalist and American Unitarian Universalist minister. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship. This is a service because it means to serve you, and it's worship from worthship. It raises to worth things that matter. My name's Jenny Dyster. I'm a regular worship leader here. I welcome you here on behalf of generations of Unitarians who've worshipped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. I also openly welcome you here personally as a member who values your attendance, your involvement and support, but most of all, love with the places you were born or lived, the calm or disquiet of your inner self. You are all of immeasurably high and equal inherent worth to us all. We're a spiritual community that encourages and supports all who come to find, fashion and follow their own spiritual path. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. We welcome you to join with us after the service for conversation. And today it looks as if we have no children. So I'm going to skip the children's story, which was just going to be about unlost stuff because it matches the theme for today. We'll move on to candles. It's our tradition to share the significant events of our spiritual lives. I invite you to deepen and to bind that fellowship and covenant with each other by sharing with us any recent event that's been significant in your spiritual life, and to mark that sharing by lighting a candle and telling us as briefly as possible about it. As some things lie too deep for words, you're very welcome to light a candle in silence. If you choose not to share, you can still take part in the widening circle of compassion by listening with an open heart. I will open our worship space for this sacred act that draws us together in our shared humanity, and as usual, I will light the first candle.
Reading is When Things Go Missing. This is from The New Yorker, Feb 2017, by Catherine Schultz, and edited by Jenny, of course. Over a lifetime, we will lose some 200,000 items apiece, plus money, relationships, elections, loved ones, etc. This makes for interesting reading because I recently moved house and misplaced so many items, and I'm constantly looking. A couple of years ago, I spent the summer in Portland, Oregon, losing things. I normally live on the East Coast, but that year, unable to face another sweltering August, I decided to decamp to the West. Some acquaintances there needed a house sitter. Another friend was away and happy to loan me her pickup truck. Someone sold me a bike for next to nothing. In very short order and with very little effort, everything fell into place. And then, mystifyingly, everything fell out of place. My first day in town, I left the keys to the truck on the counter of a coffee shop. The next day, I left the keys to the house in the front door. A few days after that, at an outdoor cafe, I took off the long-sleeve shirt I'd been wearing, only to leave it hanging over the back of the chair when I headed home. When I returned to claim it, I discovered that I'd left my wallet behind as well. Yet later that afternoon, I stopped by at a sporting goods store to buy a lock for my new bike and left my wallet sitting next to the cash register. I got the wallet back, but the next day I lost the bike lock. I'd just arrived home and removed it from its packaging when my phone rang. I stepped away to take the call, and when I returned sometime later, the lock had vanished. Eventually, having spent an absurd amount of time looking for the lock and failing to find it, I gave up and drove the truck downtown instead. I parked, went to the event, hung around talking for a while afterward, browsed the bookshelves, walked outside into a lovely summer evening, and could not find the truck anywhere. I walked around looking for the truck first on the street where I was sure I'd parked, then on the nearest cross streets, and then in a grid whose scale grew ever larger and more ludicrous. Finally, I returned to the street where I'd started and noticed a small sign: no parking anytime. I called the Portland Police Department. The man who answered was wonderfully affable. "No, ma'am," he veritably sang into the phone. "No pickup trucks from downtown this evening. Must be your lucky day." 75 minutes later, I found the truck in a perfectly legal parking space on a block so unrelated to any reasonable route from my house to the bookstore that I seriously wondered if I'd driven there in some kind of a fugue state. My sister is a cognitive scientist at MIT, more conversant than most people in the mental processes involved in tracking and misplacing objects. She was gratifyingly astonished that I'd never lost my wallet before. But as someone who typically has to reconstruct the entire contents of her own several times a year, she was not exactly sympathetic. Nor did my sister have any good advice. Plenty of parents, self-help gurus, and psychics will offer to assist you in finding lost stuff. But most of their suggestions are either, number one, obvious; calm down, clean up; number two, suspect; the 18-inch rule, whereby the majority of missing items are supposedly lurking less than 2 feet from where you first thought they would be; or three, new agey. Picture a silvery cord reaching from your chest all the way out to your lost object. Countless websites devoted to recovering lost pets are largely useless, but can also be counted on for excellent anecdotes. Like the one about the cat that vanished in Nottinghamshire, England, and was found 14 months later in a pet food warehouse, twice its original size. So I sincerely hope you haven't lost anything of importance to you, because today's reading is not going to help you much at all. Unless you're a cat, of course.
Thanks, Minnie. And I did have one other candidate for asking to read that one. I'd forgotten that you'd just shifted house, but Mary had a wonderful story about Iran's lost ring. And I suggest in coffee hour you ask about it, because it's a ripper. So I'm going to start with a poem. The art of losing isn't hard to master.
So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day, except the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing further, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and faster, some realms I owned. Two rivers, a continent. I miss them. But it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love. I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. The poem is by Elizabeth Bishop. During her lifetime, she was a respected but somewhat obscure figure in American lit. But since her death, her reputation's grown enormously to the extent that many critics refer to her as one of the most important American poets of the 20th century. She was a perfectionist who didn't write prolifically, but preferred instead to spend long periods of time polishing her work. And I think you'll agree that poem was very polished. It's a villanelle. Sounds French, doesn't it? And the form did arise in the time of the troubadours, you know, medieval music, love, sensitivity, all that stuff. And I think you'd have to be a perfectionist to write it. It's a 19-line poem with five three-line stanzas called tercets and a quatrain. The rhyming scheme allows for only two sets of rhymes, ABA for the tercets and ABAA for the quatrain. So that's an awful lot of rhyming words that you've got to find with the same rhymes. Now, that's not all. There are repeat lines, like in many songs. The first and third lines of the first tercet are repeated alternately in every other verse. And then they come together in the final quatrain, like the punchline of a joke. Now, you probably know one other villanelle, all of you. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. It's probably Dylan Thomas's most famous work. Now, did I pick one out because I felt like teaching poetry this morning? No, of course not. It's the subject matter, loss. It's so evocative. It's relevant to our current predicament. And it's so relevant to our lives, all our lives. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost, that their loss is no disaster. The odd sock, the dropped glove, the umbrella, the hat, the scarf left behind. These losses are a vexation to the spirit rather than a disaster, aren't they? The lost shopping list, the phone number you scribbled down. It drives you crackers. You get very, very cross with yourself or any other family member for losing these things. But this poem escalates. Lose something every day. Except the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. There's more discomfort with the second tercet. The loss of keys can turn you into a flustered, dithering wreck. And what about when you lose your mobile phone or your wallet? I am inclined to mislay one of these items when I'm stressed. Their loss is a wake-up call for me to look at what I've taken on board. Have I bitten off more than I can chew? Or am I worried about something that I'm not giving sufficient attention to and it's just distracting me? The hour badly spent might be spent looking for the aforesaid items. But I'm sure we can think of other ways of badly spending an hour. Getting into arguments you can never win with partners or children. Watching bad TV or a movie on Netflix that turns out to be a dud. Spending too much time scrolling through social media posts. You don't get that hour back. But get over it. The art of losing isn't too hard to master. Then practice losing further, losing faster. Places and names where you're meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster.
why should we practice losing things? Surely losing things comes from being stressed or disorganized. I remember a close friend of mine being quite exasperated with me when I arrived 45 minutes late for dinner. Why can't you just develop some routines? Put your bloody keys in the same place. I took a leaf out of her book and purchased a row of brass cats for my front door. I still have them, and 90% of the time I do the right thing and the keys go on those cats. The other 10% of the time, it doesn't happen. It's easy for routines to come unstuck when you're worried about something or when the unexpected happens. A phone call, bad news, and things unravel. There is no way you can prevent the loss of items. You might be able to, with organisation, improve your rate, but 100% mindfulness would be required to never lose anything. The suggestion that you should practice losing might just make sense. If you practice what you're good at, you get better, don't you? And if you practice what you're crap at, you get better too. An example? Lisette Oropesa. She was good at singing. She was so good that she won a place in a program run by the Metropolitan Opera in New York. The catch was she wasn't very good at exercise. At 21 years of age, she weighed 95 kilograms. She was advised that to have a real future in opera, she'd have to lose weight. So she joined a gym. Now, gym membership is not transferable. When you're on tour, you can't get to your local gym. And she and her husband discovered running. You can do that anywhere. It took about 3 years to settle into a sustainable diet and exercise pattern. And last year, that's 2020, she appeared in Runner's World and the famous German opera magazine. She's 37 now, trim, taut and terrific for well over 10 years because of practice. So practice losing. You'll get better at it. But who would want to lose anything except weight? No one, surely. I was in Melbourne for the gala opening of the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra at the beginning of 2020. I had time to kill in the afternoon and I wandered into an arcade not far from Flinders Street Station. There was an exhibition of original artworks from Dr. Seuss. Very whimsical, and on a low table for kids there were crayons and paper to draw. I glanced at it and the word loser hit me in the face. The big playground insult. You loser. Now, when I was a child, loser just meant the opposite to winner. The team that lost the grand final. The person who didn't win the singles match in tennis. You certainly didn't refer to all people who didn't win a talent quest as losers. But since then, there's been a twist and an extension in meaning. And I can track that development, this semantic shift in my lifetime. It was in 1996 at the Atlanta Olympics that Nike used the slogan, "You don't win silver, you lose gold." And Michael Jordan wore gold sneakers instead of Reeboks, which were the official sponsors. He won both the 200 and 400 sprints. I think he got exposed as a cheat after that, but that was years later. Public acceptance of sneering at losers grew. And so did self-hatred. In 2004, that's 8 years later, the reality TV show, ironically titled The Biggest Loser, went on air in the USA. It's still on, isn't it? And it's copied in every country. I was perturbed by the behaviour of primary school kids at a sports day. The fourth place getters were getting applauded, the third barely at all, and the second ignored completely because the winners went berserk. The following week, I gave my class a geometry lesson. We drew a victory dais with three levels for first, second and third, and then parallel lines to make it look 3D. Bit of a challenge. I then shared Steve Bidulph's take on ugly winner behaviour. The cartoon shows number two and number three glaring up at number one, who's got his middle fist up, doing the finger, and is gloating over his victory. We rehearsed proper winner behaviour, thought of generous things to say, and then added to our cartoon. This came back to bite me 3 months later when a child took her sketchbook home and the parents saw this good work stamp on the podium. Ignored the wonderful, masterful geometrical drawing with 3D and focused on the Interestingly, the principal didn't see my point of view at all, had clearly forgotten the ungracious behaviour of the winners on sports day, and reprimanded me soundly for poor judgment and inappropriate sourcing of materials. Well, who was the biggest loser that day? And that, of course, is why you need to practice the art of losing, because it doesn't matter how good your intentions are. You will be misunderstood sometimes. You'll lose face. You'll lose arguments. You'll be reproached for things said and done, sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly. Ongoing cooperation and civility are dependent on you being able to be a good loser. And this does need to be practiced, and I guess that's why we persist with playing cards and board games with our children. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. And this, dear friends, is when it gets a little bit more fraught. I lost house after house, friend after friend, school after school as a child, as we moved from Peterborough to Minipa, Minipa to Lee Creek, Lee Creek to Ardrossan, Ardrossan to Mount Gambier. I had the typical childhood of the offspring of teachers, postmasters and bank managers. But it could have been worse. Some kids had parents who were fleeing from debt collectors and they would be forbidden to make any contact with old friends. By contrast, my parents always prepared us for the next move and encouraged us to write letters to our old friends, but it didn't nullify or prevent the loss. When I read the biography of Bishop, I found the watch very poignant. Her father had died before she was 1 year of age, and her mother was institutionalised when she was five, mental illness. She then was looked after by her grandparents, and then she lost them when the rich grandparents from the other side of the country took over. And so it was loss after loss after loss. So the loss of a watch was more than the loss of a timepiece. Objects can carry a bucket load of significance and emotion. When we're confined to our houses and gardens and our gaze falls on things, we can feel flashes of joy or pangs of loss. In the past year, we've had more than enough time to dwell on our losses or get busy with projects to avoid thinking about them. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. That verse reminds me very much of dear friends who've had to move around the world to follow careers in diplomacy, music, science, and the arts. Their lives are enriched by living in different cultures, but there is often an underlying longing for what is lost. And now for the climax of the poem. The most profound loss in the poem, the loss of a life partner, or parent, or child. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied, it's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master. Though it may look like, write it, like disaster. The art of losing isn't hard to master becomes the art of losing isn't too hard to master. It's just a little concession, but the author no longer sounds quite as confident. Though it may look like, write it, like disaster. This points to anguish, but she does not succumb and admit it looks like disaster. Is she in denial? Well, probably, but she won't admit that, and she doesn't succumb. Bishop wasn't, after all, a confessional poet. Plath was. Bishop would never have written, "Out of the ash I rise with my red hair and I eat men like air." Many 20th century poets did write very directly about their own lives, as Plath did in her novel The Bell Jar and in her poetry. Bishop's writing involved much drafting and redrafting, which is why, having looked at earlier versions, I can be pretty sure of the identity of the continent and the lover. As it is, the removal of the personal and specific makes poetry universal. We probably all know of stories of people whose lives are cannibalised by regret. and they end up committing suicide. But we also know stories of people who have survived catastrophic losses, like Walter Michak, whose beautiful wife and daughters were killed in the Port Arthur massacre, or Sonali Dharani Yagala, sole survivor of her family in the tsunami that hit Sri Lanka in 2004. So you might see why I think learning to lose might be essential. One doesn't, after all, choose to lose anything. And the poet really does concede the disastrous quality of loss at the end of the poem, but does not succumb, and nor should we, when we have so much still to offer. Before I read the poem again for you to ponder, and because you may be looking for a movie to watch, may I recommend Reaching for the Moon, also known as Flores Rares in Portuguese. It's about Elizabeth Bishop's 17-year sojourn in South America, and it stars the Australian actress Miranda Otto. Or if you can cope with something rather stronger, there's Wave, in which Sonali Dharani Yagala wrote that to help her through her devastating losses. This book came out, I think, in about 2013.
So I didn't set out to write a book intentionally. The book happened almost by accident, as it were. Initially I was writing very much for myself. I was writing to explore and to unravel what happened to me, firstly in the water, and that's where I began writing about what happened to me in that water, because it was so bewildering and I was so stunned by it even 2 years later. So it began as just for myself to understand the experience I'd been through. And at the time when I began writing, I was also terribly afraid of memory, afraid of details, of remembering my children or my husband or my parents. And gradually with the writing, I began to reach for details and recover them. And the writing kind of allowed me to do that in a way that seemed safe at the time. And the book is essentially about love and the endurance of love. And if there's anything I'd like a reader to take away from the book, is that love never dies and that love endures. And this book really was my survival. It was my way of reaching into my memory and recovering details of my family and of keeping them with me.
Now, Michak and Dharani Yagala have both recovered, but they've not forgotten their immense losses. And their losses were not a result of distraction. They weren't a result of inattention or stress. They occurred when they were on holiday with their families. They occurred without warning, random events, and no possibility of restoration. And so Elizabeth's poem takes us from the shallows to the depths. So in conclusion, let's share one art once more. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing further, losing faster. Places and names, and where it was you meant to travel. None of these things will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them. But it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love. I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing is not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. Today's benediction comes from Cynthia Landrum, American Universalist. Be true, be well, be loving. We leave this gathered community, but we don't leave connection.
our concerns, our care for each other, our service to each other, to the world, and to our faith continues, until we are together again, friends. Be strong, be well, be true, be loving.
Enjoy this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.